Bobbig.
I am the final slot of the day, so I'm all that stands between you and the dinner. And there have been so many exciting talks today. So what I'm going to do first is I'm trying to jog your brain a bit. So I'm going to need your help. I have some puzzles for you in this presentation. The first one is this. So one line of code, very simple line of code. First question is, where would this line of code be typically used? Any ideas? I see a raised hand.
Binary search.
Yes, exactly. So that line of code you would see in almost all the introduction to algorithms or introduction to data structures courses, right? Good. So what's wrong with it? Someone else?
Integer overflow.
Yes, integer overflow. If you're using this in Java, where integer has 32 bits, and you're working with a particularly large array, then this might actually overflow, and you get an array index out of bounds exception. So that's not very nice, is it? And this is not news. So this one guy called Joshua Block, who knows a little bit about programming, he wrote this article in 2006. Read all about it. Nearly all binary searches and merge sorts are broken. So yeah, it's been a while. This is a known problem. And I mean, this can be fixed, right? But how likely would it be that you would catch that problem by testing? How likely is it that you would put in a large enough array to actually trigger the problem? Not very unlikely, right? Okay, I have another puzzle. So good job. First puzzle completed. Second puzzle. This is a picture from, I think, 2016. You see here on the left. That was a conference called FlatMap in Oslo. As you can guess, it's a Scala conference. Now, the people here are sorted. Can you tell me what criterion we used for sorting those people? Yes?
Number of publications.
No. Someone else?
Length of beard.
Great! We are ordered by a beard length. So, by the way, the guy on the right, Rickard Nilsson, he wrote the first and the largest quick check port for Scala check. And it just happened to be that some of us had big beards and some others did not. I still don't have one. So, in Java, we can write it like this. So we have a list of people and we can call the sort function on it. And then we can use this fancy lambda syntax, and we can say, well, let's compare X is beard with Y is beard. Should be simple, right? Sorting solve problem. So what's wrong with it?
The parenthesis second problem. Is called.
Sorry?
The parenthesis is called, the one at the bottom.
There's a wrong parenthesis?
It was a
joke. OK. But anyway, there's still a problem with it, and I guess this problem is not so easy to see. Huh? Maybe someone else has an idea? Yes? In the front?
It might be null, and then there is no field here.
Okay, yeah, good point. Okay, admittedly, this is a bit trickier, but the problem is this code could also give an array index out of bounds exception, just by calling a sort. And to be honest, this bug has been fixed, but it was a pretty fatal bug in the JDK that Java Utils Collections of Sort was broken. And a few people from the Netherlands and Germany, from academia, found this problem. And it was once again a problem that could only have been triggered by supplying large enough arrays into the or lists into that sort function.
Don't they have a bug tracker so that you don't have to buy papers and you have
to Yes, so there was obviously a bug being raised in the JDK, but the reason why they published this as a paper is because they used some novel methods to actually uncover that bug. And I will talk about that later, because it turns out they used something that goes beyond testing. But by now I hope you kind of got the idea, like even things that are fairly common, so for example that line of code that you saw in the binary search or the sort function, they have been used in practice quite a lot and they've been fairly well tested, right? You can't say about the JDK that it's not well tested or not widely deployed. Right? So some of these bugs can still occur.
Did they use the sort function to sort the numbers to associate them with their?
I don't think so. so, no. I think this is something like randomized source or something like that. Right, so let's talk about programming in Buzz. Let's talk about the typical programmer or engineering workflow. So at the first, when we start doing something, we would first need to come up with the requirements, right? So we write down the requirements so that we know what we're supposed to do. Then we come up with a design and maybe an architecture. And once we have completed that, we go towards the implementation stage. And once we have implemented it, we can test. And then once it's all tested, we can go into operation, right? So this is the typical workflow. Sometimes we have some cycles in there, but some feedback loops. But generally speaking, this is how it broadly speaking looks. Now, the problem is, we don't like bugs, yet somehow in that process, they keep cropping up. They keep happening for some reason. So we write tests, we fix them, but somehow they keep reappearing, right? Now, those bugs, they can creep up in many of these phases, or like in all of these different phases, they can appear. They can appear in operations when we have some kind of freak accident, some server crashes, and then some other server was relying on it, and then the whole system collapsed. Or they can happen also at the requirements phase. So it turns out that maybe our customer told us something that they don't actually need, and then we build that, and somehow this doesn't work with what they expected. Now the problem is that our ability of fixing those bugs really depends on where in that phase they occur, right? So there are some phases of development where we're quite good at fixing bugs, and there are some phases where we're quite bad. And typically, if we're talking about debugging, we're only talking about this latter half. So we're talking about seeing a red test and then finding the code that calls it, or looking at, I don't know, chaos engineering to kill some servers and see what happens and then fixing that problem. But we're really not so good at fixing bugs in the requirements on the design, right? So that doesn't mean that debugging in the later phases is not a good skill to have. So I just randomly searched Google for debugging books and I found this eclectic selection. So here we have 9 indispensable rules for finding even the most elusive software and hardware problems. There's also apparently a whole science behind debugging. This one, in the middle one, it's a bit newer than the others, and you can't read it. It says, cloud-native debugging in Kubernetes and production. So our systems, especially our operations, are becoming so complex that we need specific books on finding bugs in a running Kubernetes system. And this is all good, right? So knowing about these techniques, it's great. I don't want to dunk on those books and those authors, though. They contain extremely valuable advice. But my point is that maybe we should look a bit further than that. Now, some of you might argue that the state of the art in most software development is that we're not even doing testing correctly. So maybe we should, before we start talking beyond testing, maybe we should fix testing first. And it turns out there's also an academic paper on this. Well, I have some papers in this talk from 2014 from the OCA conference. And they say simple testing can prevent most critical failures. So they have analyzed the systems and they found out that if someone had just written a few tests, then those problems would not have happened. So case closed, right? There's also other techniques that we could be looking at. We could also look at, for example, code review. So this is a paper from 2015, Empirical Software Engineering, and they looked at the effectiveness of code review on code quality, and they found that, indeed, there is an advantage if we do code review. I mean, obviously, we have to do code review correctly, but this will also improve software quality. There's lots of other papers as well. I think there's also a paper that explains that if you're rested, you write better code. So don't try to code at night, actually, unless you have that sort of sleep cycle. But if you have like a normal sleep cycle and you code at 3 a.m., your code's probably not going to be as good as you're writing in 3 p.m. So there's all sorts of these effects on code quality, but I mean, this talk is not generally about code quality. The talk is more about how we don't really know in our day-to-day lives how to go beyond testing. So how do we actually have this very formal assurance about our code, this very high confidence. So yeah, we're just trying to do our best, right, with the tools that we have. And of course, no talk about testing and formal methods and so on can go without that quote from Edsger Dijkstra. Program testing can be a very effective way to show the presence of bugs, but is hopelessly inadequate for showing their absence, right? So if you have green tests in IntelliJ or wherever, we cannot be confident that there are no bugs. Only if there's red tests, we know that there are bugs, but not the other way around. So, how do we fix it? Let's talk about formal methods. I'm very passionate about formal methods, and fortunately I'm not the only person in the room with a PhD in formal methods, so this is a very good audience. I have another quote to explain what formal methods are. This is from Silvia Munoz from the small government agency called NASA in the United States. And he defines it as follows. Formal method refers to mathematically rigorous techniques and tools for the specification, design, and verification of software and hardware systems. Right? So there's a few key points here. Mathematically rigorous is the important one, I think. But also that it's tools. So we can also use tools in our development workflow to employ those formal methods. Now, I'm going out on a limb here and say most of you, if not all of you, have already used or even are continuously using formal methods in your day-to-day programming life. Because it turns out that there's no one type or class of formal methods. There's a whole bunch of them. And we can group them according to rigor. So this is the one axis. Rigor means the higher it goes up there, the more assurances it gives you to some extent, or the more formal it is, if you want. And then we also have this other axis here, the coverage axis. And the terminology is a bit muddy here, so I've been trying to make a bit of sense to people who are not used to these formal methods tools. So on the right implementation means we're actually talking about single lines of code, essentially. So we're actually talking about the real implementation we're having. We actually get assurance about the code that we're running. And then here specification means we're talking about a more abstract level. So we're not talking about exact implementation details, but maybe we're just looking at a call graph, for example. Now, why did I just make the conjecture about most or all of you using formal methods already? Because type systems are one particular kind of formal methods. Now, why is that? Well, the type checker gives you an answer whether it thinks that your program is correct according to the typing rules or not. And if the type checker is well implemented and it gives you a green light, then it means that at least you don't get the type error or something like that when running your program. Now, of course, not all of these type checkers are completely correctly implemented, but they also have to make some pragmatic trade-offs. But generally speaking, if the type checker says yes, then you have very high assurance that your program actually works correctly. Now, the type checker, unless you're talking about a dependent type system, which probably not all of you are using in your day-to-day life, only talks about the method signatures. So this is already some kind of abstraction from your actual code that's running, right? You could still be making other mistakes directly in the implementation of a method as long as you're satisfying the method signature, the type checker will say yes. Now, another system or another class of formal methods would be something like state machines. So if I'm just using a piece of paper and I'm drawing some circles or boxes and some arrows and saying, okay, I have a system that can have, like, broadly speaking, five different states, and here's what events can happen and what transitions it's making, I can already model something formally. For example, if I'm building software for a vending machine, I would have the state where nothing has happened yet, so I'm idle, and then I have an event like I'm putting in some coins, or at an event, someone pushes the return button to refund the coins, or someone types in the number, so you have some kind of space, and then you can describe those transitions. Now, typically, if you do something on a piece of paper, you have no tool that tells you that something is correct or not. But it's still a formal method, because there's a formalism that describes how this works, and you can already get some idea, some insight about your system, if you're forced to think about all the different transitions and all the different states that your system could be in. Now, another one, somewhere in the middle, is first order logic. Who here knows what first order logic is? Okay, that's a few people. In the earlier talk, there was a very BobConf moment where we started talking about some Haskell code and then ended up discussing about vector bundles in category theory or something like that. I'm not going to do that here. So if you know, you know. If you don't, no worries. Another thing that goes a bit more towards the right, which I also found surprising, so a friend of me told me that flowcharts are actually also a class of formal methods. Why? Because flowcharts actually have formal semantics. There's an ISO standard, and I will show it to you on the next slide so that you believe me. I mean, you know flowcharts, right? You've probably drawn some flowcharts in Confluence or wherever, right? They have formal semantics. So you could be doing formal analysis on them if you really wanted to. But flowcharts are also kind of like a bit propped up state machines where you also can do like conditions and like asynchronous things and so on and so on. Okay, another example, model checking. Model checking goes even more towards the implementation side of things and a bit more rigor. These class of tools, they would allow you to write a model of your system in a particular kind of logic. So it's a bit more advanced than first order logic, because it also can talk about something like time and distributed systems and so on. So time and distributed systems are also a bit difficult. And this, you know, gives you already an idea of something like, I have a sequence of events, and I did not expect a sequence of events, but it can happen because of interleaving of different processes, and then some safety thing is violated. So if you look at the vending machine example, it could come up with a sequence of events where it tells you, well, actually, if you put in the coins and then you press return 5 times, then actually you get the bottle out instead of the money back or something like that. So this is would be tools that could uncover these kind of problems. Right. So even more on the implementation side, we could also have a property testing. Now, property testing is probably also quite familiar to some of you. Maybe some of you are already using it routinely. Idea is that you write not just a simple unit test that calls a function with a particular set of values, but instead you write a template, and then your property testing library would instantiate that template with 100 different sets of inputs. So you're saying x plus y must equal y plus x, and then it calls it with many different values of x and y and checks if it's correct. And then, of course, on the top right, we have the theorem provers, which are kind of the gold standard. Because in theorem provers, you can do basically everything. You can model everything that you would want to do. You can also reason about actual implementations. So you could, for example, import C code into that theorem prover and then make some statements about that. So just to give you an idea, there's quite a lot of bandwidth. Nicole, do you have a question?
Do you really want to imply that type systems are more rigorous than model checking and equally rigorous as theorem
provers? No, I'm not going to imply anything. This is a completely randomized. So it's this is not a scientific ordering of things. This is just. Yeah, but it's a good point. So this all of these, all of these axes can be argued about. Anyway, I promised you the slides on ISO, on the ISO norm for flowcharts. I found this on Google, so apparently there's something to help you draw those flowcharts, and it's also fully specified. So if you look at that ISO document, you have to pay for it, by the way. You can't get it for free, it's not open source. So you have all of these boxes and the description of how those boxes are to be interpreted. Now, the key point here is those boxes are syntax, and then the description is semantics. So it tells you exactly when you're looking at a flowchart, okay, I have the normal rectangle, or I have that rectangle with some additional bars, then this is exactly what it means. And then you can talk about it, because there can be no misunderstanding of what's happening. Now, I've shown you a bunch of these different types of formal methods, and I kind of want to zero in on this top right corner where we go with the theorem provers. And this one is, of course, the flowcharts are, of course, not so formal and not so rigorous, but this definition here that I showed you, this ISO standard, I showed you for a reason, because it has this quite nice explanation of syntax and semantics. And this is what we want to do in program verification. Because in program verification, we have something like a specification that we start out with, and we have an actual implementation of a program, and then we want to establish somehow that they are somehow connected. So we want to establish that the implementation satisfies the specification. And of course, in order to do that, we need a good idea of what the syntax and the semantics of the underlying program is. So if you want to formalize something like a Java program, then we would need to have some understanding of what the Java syntax means. So we would need to understand how the syntax tree of Java is structured, and also how the semantics of that system works. But we can also do it in a bit more fine, granular way, because typically you would not write directly a specification of a Java program. Instead, you would have this middle step here. So you would first start with an abstract specification, so you would somehow write down mathematically what you want to happen, and then you go a bit more towards something that we call executable specification. Now, what does it mean? An abstract specification, for example, you can talk about sets, mathematical sets, sets that can be infinite. You can do funny operations on those sets, and you don't have to care if those operations can actually be executed on a real machine or if they can be efficiently executed. And then in the executable specification, you would start replacing those abstract mathematical concepts with more concrete things like a set you can implement based on a hash table or something like that, or go based on some red black tree or something like that. And then you go from there to the actual implementation. And you can make as many steps as you want here. Most of these theorem proving tools, they will allow you to do something like that. But I don't want to spend so much here on the theory. I actually want to talk a bit about the practice, what we're doing at Giesecke and Debian. Now, we're not marketing our products directly to end users, so this, by definition, cannot be a marketing section of the talk. But I have another puzzle for you. So here's four pictures. There's a picture of shells. This is supposed to be salt. And then I have gold and banknotes. Now, does anyone know what the connection between those pictures is?
They're all currencies.
Yes, they're all currencies, correct. And there's even something more specific, which is that currencies across, like, along the time, right? So no one will pay with shells anymore, or with salt, but nowadays you tend to use banknotes because they're quite convenient. Now, what we're doing is we're building the next phase in that, and this is not related to blockchain, by the way, so this is not, I'm not gonna evangelize on the virtues or not virtues of DLT or something like that, but the key idea here is that we're building a financial product. We're building some kind of monetary system, and this is called central bank digital currency. Now, central bank digital currency, some of you may have heard about it, or not, doesn't matter. But the key idea is that it's something, it's a type of money that's directly issued by the central bank, but can be used digitally. So right now, if you as a citizen or just human want to use money from the central bank, the only thing that you can do is you can hold physical cash. Because everything else, like credit cards or PayPal or whatever, is private money. It's not issued by the central bank. So the key idea here is that we want to have some kind of instrument that has the stability of the central bank currency, coupled with the convenience of electronic payments. Now, I think if I tell you that this needs to satisfy the highest security guarantees, you will immediately believe me, right? Because people generally don't like if they lose money, maybe because of a programming bug. And our customers, which are basically financial institutions, also don't like it if they lose money. Unfortunately, this has happened in the past, right? So I have a few headlines here from glitches from financial institutions. And you know, if you have enough money on your bank account, you might not care. But if you do not have so much money on your bank account, and then I don't know, DKB has somehow doubled all your rent payments and whatnot, then you might not like that, right? So it could be a problem for you. So all that goes to say, these kind of formal methods are quite interesting in our field, because we don't just want to test and have sort of like a basic coverage, we want to really have a rock solid product. Now, the way that we represent this money is in a tokenized form. So token here means we have something like a public-private key pair, elliptic curve cryptography, nothing too exciting, and that would actually represent the money, it would represent the value. So the central bank would mint or issue those tokens, and then there's a denomination attached to them. And then with those tokens, you can send them around, and you can split them, you can merge them, and especially you can use them for payments. Now, how does this work? Internally speaking, we have kind of like a model of how these tokens evolve over time, how they're being used, how they're being spent. And it's a graph-based model. So if you look at an example, we would have some kind of operation that's executed by the central bank, a create operation, and that just makes money appear out of thin air. That's what central banks can do, right? Central banks, they can just make money appear. That's how they do it with banknotes, and how they can do it with this central bank digital currency. So let's just say they create a token worth 10 euro, and then they want to distribute it to, I don't know, one bank gets 2 euro and someone else gets 8 euro, then they can do a split. And then, obviously, if you do a split, you do not change the total amount. You only change the total amount if you actually create value. But for the split, for example, we want to ensure that you cannot suddenly create more money that has existed previously. But we can also do a merge. So use case for that would be, I have 4 euro sitting in my wallet, and someone gives me 7 euro, then I can merge it together, and now I have 11 euro. And also it would be a bad idea if I could create more money by running this command. So basically, we distinguish between something that we call privileged and unprivileged commands. Privileged commands would be executed by the central bank, so they can change the monetary supply. Unprivileged commands cannot change the monetary supply, and everyone can use them, depending on whatever type of wallet that they're using. So if we look again at that graph model, we can kind of group these things together, because this graph is not so nice. It has two different types of things in it. So we have these rectangles, which are the operations, and then we have the circles, which are the tokens. So we group them together to something that we call commands. And basically, a command is a collection of one operation together with all of the tokens that it somehow manipulates. And then we want to make some statements over how those commands can behave. In particular, we want to prove something like, you cannot use a token in a command for the second time, because if you use it, it's been used up and you cannot do it again, because otherwise, if you could do that, it would be double spending, right? So I would have a token of 10 euro and I'm doing something with it, and then I'm doing something else with it, I would have just created money out of thin air. I can't do that. So I want to prove that if I'm using the token, it actually disappears from circulation. That's the general idea. So the way that we would write this is in the following form. So there's a bit of mathematics going on here. This left is a sum sign, and it says UTXO here. UTXO is the technical term for this kind of double spending protection we're using. It's called unspent transaction outputs. But it doesn't matter, I put the bracket there, it's basically the money in circulation. It's all the tokens that are available for use. And this is supposed to be equal to the sum of all the tokens that have ever been created, minus all the tokens that have been destroyed by the central bank. This makes sense, right? The central bank can create money, they can destroy money, and the difference between what they have created and what they have destroyed should be the money in circulation. And this can never change. It's not supposed to change. Only if the central bank decides to make more money, then they can do that. But if they don't, then I can only just switch around and merge and split and so on, and don't change the monetary supply. So this looks like a quite simple equation, but it turns out that this is actually quite involved to prove. And the way that we did that was in this system, it's called Isabel. And if you start Isabel, it looks like an IDE. A bit like an old-fashioned IDE because you use a Java-based editor that's called JEdit. I think maybe 10 years ago JEdit was popular, but it's not anymore. And you can write data type, you can write functions, so it looks like something like Haskell, ML sort of thing. It has code completion, it has control clicking to jump, and all of these things. So it looks like a fairly normal programming language. And this is exactly how it's defined, so to speak. So this is from Tobias Mitko, who is one of the main people behind Isabel. And he defined it as functional programming plus logic. So we can write functional programs, and we can then argue about the semantics. Right, so we did that. We modeled a large part of our system in Isabel, and we have this mathematical model of coins, as they're typically called, and how these evolve. So we have, for example, defined what a create looks like, what a merge looks like, and so on. And then we employed some graph theoretic arguments to prove the correctness of that. And we have some high-level correctness properties and also a reference implementation. So what we can do in Isabel is we can take this code that we've written in this programming language and then have it compiled to another programming language, for example, to Scala. Now, as I've mentioned earlier, the Scala implementation is actually very inefficient. So most of the operations in the Scala reference implementation would use cubic time, but you would want something like logarithmic or O of 1 if you're doing database or constant access, right? So cubic is really, really bad. But it's at least something that you can compare against the actual implementation which is written in Go. But we'll talk about Go a bit later. All of our backend systems are written in Go. Now, the way that you would write this in Isabel, this exact theorem that I just showed you to you in your earlier slide with the handwritten, is, looks like this. So I first define the balance, the total balance in the graph. And you also can use this sigma, the sum here in Isabel directly. And you say, well, you take all the unspent things and you sum them up, the value of those things, and then you prove, well, actually the balance of the graph is equally defined to be the value difference of all the commands. Value difference here means if I have a create command, it actually produces a difference. So a create command versus new money into existence. So you have a positive value difference. But if you just use one of the other commands, then the value difference would be zero. So this is the mathematical statement, or the more formal mathematical notation of what I've just shown you before. I obviously did not put all the background here, but suffice to say, this is actually copy-pasted from our implementation, so we actually have that verified. And you might just say, well, Gisek and Dipkin is just doing that because Lars has a PhD in that topic, so obviously they would want to do that because, you know, Lars is there doing that. But it's not just us. There's other people doing that as well. I have here some publicly available statements. So we know AWS does it, we know CockroachDB does it, we know Intel does it, we know Google does it. We also know that Apple does it, although they don't really talk about it that much. But in the latest, I know a few people working at Apple on their formal methods division, and last year in some of their shareholder report, they mentioned it was like one half sentence they're doing it. So now it's well known that they're doing it. And you might say, well, this is all very expensive and you need specialized people. You know, maybe I don't care so much about the correctness of these things, but yeah, I want to briefly mention that there's also other advantages that you can get beyond correctness of your programs. And this is something that I would call proof-driven development, PDD. Now, proof-driven development does not require to actually do proofs. For proof-driven development, it often suffices that you just sit down and write a specification of things. Because just the act of writing down a formal specification of things makes you think about all the corner cases. So you don't have to use the proof assistant. You can just write
the state machine on a piece of paper and think, actually, what happens if I press on the refund button when there's no coins in there? Does it just restart or what does it do, right? Something like that. And there's a few features that we developed like this. One of the features is batch processing. So the backend system that processes these commands used to process them one by one, which is of course not efficient if you want to do a bunch of things at the same time. So we implemented batch processing, and we wanted to prove that it actually, we wanted to know whether it can be implemented correctly, because there were some corner cases, and we successfully used that to convince ourselves that actually, yes, we can go ahead with the implementation. Then we have a garbage collection. If you have this graph of all the things, all the tokens they're doing over their entire lifetime, and you're running an entire economy on this thing with like sustained 15,000 transactions per second, you're going to have a lot of data. So at some point, you want to prune it. And here, we were also not convinced that our proposal of how to implement it would violate something like double spending. So we formalized it first and then realized there's actually a problem in our proposal. It would lead to double spending. So we had to refine the proposal a few times, and we did that before we actually implemented and shipped it. So it turns out if we had shipped it without doing that, everyone would see it in the news. Bezig and Devian has fatal double spending problem in their currency. Another thing that we're using it for is to optimize the way we do offline payments. So I couldn't talk about that because of time. We also support offline payments in our product. And when you do offline payments, you typically do it like with NFC or something like that. And I'm not sure if some of you had ever had to do something with NFC. NFC has the bandwidth that's slower than like modem, dial-up connection, right? So it's very slow. So you have to optimize the bandwidth. You cannot do like, I don't know, you cannot just send 20 megabytes over NFC. So that's something that we also need to optimize. And we have a master's student currently helping us with that, writing doing actual research on this kind of thing, how to optimize the data there, and also designing that all in Isabel. So yeah, when we do these, design these new features, we look, can it work correctly, any feature interactions that we didn't foresee, and then how can we implement it. So basically, if we go back to the initial workflow that I described to you, the PDD or specification or whatever, how you want to call it, actually helps in that initial part of the software lifecycle. Now, I think I'm running out of time, right? So then I will just quickly show you the roadmap of where we want to go with that, because there's always more things to do. First of all, we want to expand the scope of our formalization, right? So right now we're talking about the core protocol, how those tokens are manipulated. We have a lot of other software around it. We want to formalize that. We also want to add model checking to our toolbox, because we have a strongly distributed system, and distributed systems are fine as long as the parts do not talk to each other, but unfortunately they do talk to each other, and as soon as systems start talking to each other, you have problems. So we want to be a bit more better than that. And also we want to close the gap between the specification and implementation, and this is why we have another master student who's working on a Go backend for Isabel, so that we can actually use the Isabel code and compile it to Go, and then we can integrate it into the rest of our Go landscape. And hopefully that means that at some point I can say I shipped Isabel code to production. Yeah, so that's basically the goal where I want to go with that. And I think this is a good note to end this on, shipping Isabel to production. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Yeah, an easy one. Is that Go backend that's not going to be open source?
The Go backend is actually already being developed open source, so it's going to be there. I can't tell you when it will actually end up in the normal Isabel distribution, because right now it's like research quality. But yeah, it's definitely working on getting as much of that open source as soon as possible.
So once this Go backend is written, somebody has to prove that this translation actually preserves the properties that you've just proven.
Yes, that is correct.
A kind of vicious cycle?
So I was talking about that with someone earlier today about this topic. If you want to have 100% correctness, you would need to verify your CPU as well. Now, there's some point where you have to draw the line, and this translation from Isabel to Go is what we call trusted code. So we don't verify, we assume it's correct. This is a decision that we have to make because of trade-off, like we don't have infinite amount of time. I think there's actually a semantics of Go. They formalize the semantics of Go because they introduced the generics, I think, at some point. So it could be possible to also, you know, remove the trust object part of the code base and also verify it, but I think you would not just use one master student, but maybe a PhD student and three master students to do that. So yeah, it's always a matter of how much you're willing to expend on that.
Isn't there the SEL4 project or something? Could you reuse that in order to do that? Or
yeah, so the SEL4 for everyone else is a verified microkernel. So it's a low-level operating system specifically for embedded systems. And there's a verified version of SEL4 that runs, or that's verified using Isabel. And it runs in practice, and I guess for all embedded devices, we could be looking at it. Right now we have, no, that's not true, we have some parts of our code base are actually written in C, because SEL4 has a tool for importing C code into Isabel, so it's the other way around, it's not exporting Isabel to C, but it's importing the existing code. Yes, so if you're looking for a new job, would be happy to. More questions?
Yeah. I think I don't need a mic.
Please repeat it.
Yeah. You called it PDD.
Yeah.
Is it actually working like TDD that you write a line of specification and then you do the implementation, or do you do like a big bunch of specification before you start with the implementation?
So the question is about if PDD works like TDD in the process way. Do you do the red, green, refactor or something like that? No, I think this is I'm probably not the first one to say proof-driven development, but it's not like there's any books written on it by thought leaders who have the PDD framework that you just have to follow these five steps and then you're doing PDD. This is a bit tongue-in-cheek, right? So what we did is we started out with just pages on Confluence, where we just started writing down all the corner cases that you could think of, and then we're like a group of five or six people from different departments saying, okay, from the smart card perspective, this doesn't make sense, you can't do that on the smart card. And then someone said, well, in the database, this would be inefficient, blah, 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 so we did that. And at some point, we tried to extract the fundamentals of that algorithm, and then we started putting it in Isabel and saw whether it stick, and if it was correct, then you proceeded with the implementation, and then you could do the normal process, or you iterate, say, okay, Isabel doesn't like it for some reason because this is a corner case we've missed. So it's still not a fully agile end-to-end process.
Can you give us an idea about the time frame? So how much time does this take?
How much time does it take? Well, it's a bit hard to answer that question because if we hadn't done it, we would have to expend more time afterwards to find the problems while it's running. So I'd like to say it takes about the same time, but we've done it in 2 to 3 occasions in that way. So I don't know.
Is it like comparable to writing a test suite or?
So one thing I can tell you is it feels a lot more like waterfall. So it's not really that like very short feedback loop. So the feedback loops take a lot longer because in order to prove the correctness of a particular algorithm, it takes a lot longer than to implement it and to test it. So even though it might save you time later, you still have that process where you're blocked on if you can turn out to prove it. And yeah, it's definitely more waterfall-y in the beginning.
Does it replace the test, so you now don't
No.
Less test or?
So maybe I.
Oh,
answer this, and then it does not replace the tests. It, there's still some tests that you need to make sure that, I don't know, like you're talking to the database correctly or something like that. So that's still happening.
Is it a quick one?
I wanted to add a quick data point to this discussion perhaps. So I've been doing it with a colleague where we started writing a specification, and we just choose a proof assistant because it gave us a syntax for just writing down the formulas. We never even proved anything with it. And we did it once, and then the next time we forgot about it, or at least I forgot about it. My colleague comes to me and says, Heinrich, we should have done this time, because that would have made the implementation more straightforward, because it's precisely these things, or these corner cases we discovered during the implementation that we could have figured out earlier by just trying to write down a specification. And on that note, concerning the tests, in Haskell we do property tests, so these tests have a similar purpose to a specification. And it's actually still useful to write the specification in a language which supports the full logic, not just as a test. But then the line, what I want to say is that at least in Haskell, property tests and specification, there's a very fluid boundary there.